Well, I'd like to welcome everybody to the easy snapshot presentation entitled Mass Production of E-Texts for CSU Fullerton Students. This is one of a two-part series, which I will tell you a little more about in a minute. First, I would like to say I'm not Norm Coombs. My name is Jeff Senge. Norm wasn't able to be here today to introduce this particular presentation, and Dick is not with us today either, so myself and my colleague Mark Trin will be doing the presentation, as well as sort of the administration moderator operations at the same time. Now, I do want to warn you, neither one of us have done this before. So we're kind of, we practice a little. We have a basic understanding of what we're trying to do with running the webinar here, but we certainly don't have the wealth of experience that either Norm or Dick has. So please bear with us. If, we lock you out for a minute, we'll try to get you back in. And if for some reason things go south, we'll do our best to get them heading north again as quickly as possible. So please hang in there with us, and hopefully the information we're going to be presenting today, you will find of value. I'm going to be going through a slideshow presentation, and as I present each one of the slides, I will discuss it in detail. First of all, I'd like to thank Norm Coombs for inviting us to do this presentation, and wish Dick all the best. And I'm going to start off by introducing myself. My name is Jeff Senge. I work as the Information and Computer Access Program Coordinator at California State University Fullerton, or Cal State Fullerton, or CSU Fullerton, not to be confused with Colorado State University. We are one campus of the 23 campuses of the California State University system, and I'll tell you a little more about that in a minute. I've been in this position as the Information and Computer Access Program Coordinator for approximately 18 years. I started off here in about 1990 with a small program of four adapted computers, which I really got in on the ground floor, literally, of setting them up and starting the program here on campus 18 years ago. And all along the way, we've continued to grow, develop, and become a more robust program, and really have evolved to a level where we can serve our students quite well, I think. And my co-presenter today is Mark Trin. Mark's going to be silent today, but he will do most of the presentations on the part two of this. Mark Trin is our Instructional Materials Accessibility Specialist, and he is really responsible for the overall operation of producing the alternate format, e-text, braille, tactographics, any number of things we would do in alternate format, that really falls within his responsibilities. Years ago, I kind of did it all, I guess you could say. Like many of us, I ran the lab, scanned the books, taught the students, ran around and advocated and tried to raise money and get equipment and expand the program. At a point approximately, I would say it was about 1997, we sort of reached critical mass where I got an assistant, and then my assistant, developed more responsibilities, and that position was formulated into the alternate format or the adaptive technology specialist. So I had one staff member, and Mark's position is really the newest position we've been able to establish in the area of alternate format production. Mark started off as the alternate format production coordinator, and his job has since expanded to be instructional materials accessibility specialist, and that has a broader role, which I will discuss a little later. But he also has now a half-time instructional or alternate format production coordinator. So there gets to be more and more staffing involved, and my position as coordinator has really evolved to the point of I sort of coordinate all the activities involving adaptive technology, alternate format production, access to any kind of instructional material, really information and computer access for students, staff, and faculty throughout the campus. Now, to give you a little overview of our campus, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, we are a large public university, as all the campuses in the CSU are, and the university itself is located in a, I would consider it to be an extremely urban area, but it's not a extremely dense urban area, if you will. It's more like a suburb urban. We are located about, probably 10 miles from Disneyland, for those of you who know where that is, centrally located in northern part of Orange County, California. We have surrounding us probably for a 60-mile radius, pretty much solid development in terms of residents, business, etc. There's not a whole lot of open land within the 60-mile radius. We do serve a lot of students from throughout the state, as well as Los Angeles and Orange counties. We have a high population of commuter students, as well as a pretty robust residential program on campus, which is continuing to develop. We have about between 35 and 37,000 students, of which our Office for Disabled Student Services serves approximately 600. And out of those 600, I would say we, in the Information and Computer Access Program, we really work directly with approximately 100 to 125 of those students who may, for one reason or another, require an alternate access to information or technology. We also work with about a dozen faculty and staff members on campus, providing them with everything from adapted hardware and software to testing services to, you name it when it comes to alternate technology alternate access to information, and we're pretty much involved with it for everybody on campus at one level or another. Okay, I want to move on now to the next slide. On this slide, I want to speak a little bit about how I want to handle this presentation. So the general description of the presentation we're going to do is it's two parts. We've broken the presentation into two parts because there's really too much to cover in one part. And if we just covered what in essence is part two, which is how we produce electronic text, a lot of the awareness of what has to go on in terms of support from the campus community, we wouldn't really have time to give this a level of background. And the background, I think, is extremely critical in what we do because it's what it has enabled us to grow the program. And so that's really what part one is going to be about today. We're going to do part one today on May 1st, and it's really going to focus on the background and the overview of our program. Part two, which we're going to present on May 15th at the same time, Mark Trin is going to be the predominant presenter. And that one we've entitled Production and Tracking, because that is really going to focus on how we actually produce electronic texts and how we track our workload, etc. So that one's going to be more the nuts and bolts, and today is going to be more the conceptual aspect of how we do what we do. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. Okay, slide four. We're going to begin by talking. We're going to talk a little about part one, and part one is really leading us into background and overview. Okay, so for all of you who are that are out there, which there's about 75 of you at this time, we're going to launch into today's presentation, and the other presentation will happen 2 weeks from today, and hopefully everybody can make it back for that one. I have to make an adjustment here because I'm doing two things at once. Okay, we're back. I just have learned I have to make sure I do some activity on this on the computer that is logged in. Otherwise, I go to screensaver and kind of lose track. So I will continue to do that on a periodic basis. And let's get back to the presentation. Okay, I am back. I had to pause for just a second. So let's jump into our lecture. I think everything is set to go here. It's a challenge moderating while you're trying to present. Okay, we're going to talk a little about the background to start with, and then we're going to move into the overview. The first thing I wanted to present is the mission of what we do, to try to, as I said, give a broader overview of understanding why we do what we do. So in terms of our mission, we focus on a couple of different areas primarily, and one is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which I'm going to make the assumption most everybody in the audience is familiar with what this is about and what this law specifies. But you know, to sum it down into a brief statement, it requires us to provide equal access to our programs, services, and activities. So at a university, that's pretty much everything. If it's not a program, service, or an activity, we don't really get involved with it, but pretty much everything we do here is a program, service, or an activity. So equal access to program, services, and activities is what we're... what is our core mission value? And to really make that even more specific in terms of information and computer access, we look at Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which specifies that we need to ensure equally effective communication. So when we look at Section 504 and we say equal access to program services and activities, one of the ways that's going to be measured is, do we ensure equally effective communications? And it's been identified as meaning both written and oral. So in terms of program services and activities, are our communications, written and oral, in these areas equally effective for all students, including students with functional limitations or various disabilities? So let's move on to the next slide. The next slide, in terms of our background and our mission statement, to kind of further define beyond Section 504 and ADA, what are standards of equally effective communication? This has been identified for us by the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, and it actually happens to be Region 9, which is the region we're in, and their office is in San Francisco. And they've consistently articulated this several years ago. This was really down in the mid-1990s, and they've been consistent in their interpretation of this, that equally effective communication really consists of three components, three primary components. Timeliness of delivery is one component. And in essence, what that means is timeliness of delivery means students who receive things in alternate format or through some other process to ensure equally effective communications, it needs to be provided to these individuals in a timely fashion, which means at the same time everyone else gets it. Not 2 weeks later, not 2 days later, not 2 hours later. In hand, available, accessible, equally effective communication will be achieved at that point. Up till that, if you're not providing a timely access, you haven't achieved equally effective communication. Okay, so again, that points back to our mission statement. If we're going to, we're going to set our mission on equally effective communication, we must have timely delivery at the same time everyone else has access to that information. The second item is accuracy of translation. That's pretty self-explanatory too. I mean, in essence, what that means is what you are providing to somebody must be accurately translated. Not 80% accurate, not 90% accurate, accurate. And that's what we will be judged by in terms of the alternate format we produce. So it needs to be timely, it needs to be accurate, and it needs to be an appropriate format for the student as well as the material being presented. And in this area, preference is given to the student's requested format. So that becomes a important component. You don't necessarily get to dictate what the format that may be most convenient for you or the most cost-effective for you is. According to U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, Region 10, they specified that student preference is a priority in equally effective communication. Also, an appropriate format for the material being presented, and a simple way to probably present this is that most people get. There's a lot of subtlety to this part, but this part, in essence, might mean something like if you have a blind student who reads music braille and they're taking a course that uses music notation, the expectation is you're going to provide the music for that student in music braille if the student has requested. That's their preferred format. You're not going to give them, a less effective communication tool like maybe an audio tape or if it was a mathematics class or a science class where we have scientific formulas, or a computer science class where we have, maybe computer code. All those things need to be provided for the student in their preferred format that's also an appropriate format for that material, appropriate for equally and effectively communicating that material. So Nemeth code Braille for mathematics that a student would be familiar with. The student would request that as their preferred format. The expectation is that the institution will provide that, and it will be accurate and it will be timely. So, okay, it has to be on time, it has to be accurate, it has to be in a student's preferred format, and it has to be, in essence, in the most appropriate or best format for that material to be, effectively communicated. So those really consist of what our mission is: equal access to program services and activities, ensure equally effective communication, and we need to do that in a timely manner with accurate translation, and it needs to be in a preferred and appropriate format for the student and the material. So hopefully that lays a little groundwork of where we're going and how we're getting there. This really helps us when we look at any situation and we come back and say, okay, what are we going to do here? What is our project plan, our timeline, etc.? These elements really help us focus in on: do we need more resources if we're going to achieve this? Do we need more time if we're going to achieve this? How are we going to meet this this mission? Okay, so let's move on. Let's look at continue to look at background, and let's look at some of the challenges related to accomplishing this mission. because it's a pretty daunting task, and for most of us the primary challenge is resources, and it usually comes down to funding, staff, and space. Funding is always an issue. Trained staff is an issue with the talents and skills to do this, and frequently space is an issue. In our case, space has been more of an issue than funding or staffing, but in many instances, space is not such an issue. It's more about funding and staffing. So bottom line to this is one of the major challenges I think any university is going to face in achieving what we set out as our mission statement, timeliness, accuracy, and appropriate format, that finding the wherewithal in terms of the resources, funding, staff, and space is going to be a significant challenge. Again, that's why we're doing this background section, so you guys begin to get an understanding of what we've had to build in terms of an infrastructure to get to the point of actually producing the materials. One of the things we've realized for a lot of years is we needed to take this from it was really a segregated program to start with. It was an outside kind of a fringe, marginalized activity that we did for a few students. And at some point it moved into being what I would consider more of a bolt-on program. There was actually a program with a process and a plan to it and a structure, but it really wasn't integral. It was a bolt-on situation where nobody really knew a whole lot about what we did, but we got the job done. This process that we're moving towards now is what I think of as an integrated, institutionalized process. It really has to become part of a broader picture. It needs to be recognized by the campus as a whole. It needs to involve administrators at all levels. It needs to involve academic, faculty, vice presidents. It needs to involve students, staff. Everybody has a role to play here if we're going to accomplish timeliness. That's primarily the thing it takes a larger community commitment, is to achieve that timeliness aspect. We can deal with the accuracy, and we can deal with the preferred formats part components of what we do, but the timeliness, we're really dependent on other people in terms of early identification of materials and things of that nature for us to be able to achieve timeliness. And that was, it was, and it continues to be, but not as much as in the past, a major issue enabling us to get things done in a timely manner is other people's cooperation. So back in 2004, we really set out seriously to develop a campus-wide implementation plan to take us from a level of being able to produce accurate materials in preferred formats and appropriate formats, but not, we weren't hitting the timeliness mark. We were 50% to 60% on the timeliness mark. So that really wasn't good enough. Okay? Let's move on to the next slide. So that, in essence, that called for a new plan if we were going to do that, and that's what we developed in 2004. And since 2004, we've been in a process of implementing and refining the plan. So there we go. I had to wait for my slide to come up. Okay, continuing with background, out the slides up. As we developed the alternate format production implementation plan, we set out to really outline who all needed to be involved in this, sort of in our perfect world, in order to enable us to have the level of cooperation we needed to achieve timeliness timeliness of delivery. This timeliness of delivery to us is based on a major component being, when do we know what the material is? And we can, in most cases, produce a book or, you know, a work in its entirety in 2 weeks or less. 2 weeks would be the more complex projects. You know, the simpler projects you could do in a matter of hours or days. But to achieve this, we really needed to get an earlier start on the work, so we could make a timely delivery to students, and they would have it at the same time as every other student had it, that being their textbook in alternate format on the first day of class. So we recognized it really was going to take, you know, a community. You know, I hate to say it takes a village, but it really does take a lot of people within the community to cooperate to make this happen. So it really started at the level of the president of the university, and we realized we needed to have the president on board and being a strong advocate in order to accomplish what we were about to set out to do. We needed the vice president of academic affairs, because next to the president, he is the person that has the most, I guess you could say, influence and authority with regard to academic affairs and the faculty. So recognizing the faculty are the ones who adopt the textbooks and determine what instructional materials are going to be used at any point in time, we need to find out that information early. We need to have the academic vice president on our side of implementing this new plan. The vice president of student affairs also needs to be involved, primarily because 90% of the work that is done in terms of alternate format production comes out of his budget. The student affairs budget supports our disabled student services program on campus. In turn, disabled student services funds all, you know, staffing and all the resources that have to do with my program, alt format, as well as adaptive technology. All that level of student services is funded by the vice president of student affairs. So he needed to be on board. The chief information technology officer was actually another vice president. He needed to be on board for various and sundry reasons, which we'll get into a little later, but he plays an integral role in sort of supporting the flow of information, which assists us in getting our job done. We needed to have the entire university faculty on board, and this is an ongoing effort, but I would say we're 90% of the way there. And this happened in a relatively short amount of time without any, I don't know what we call it, not too much strong-arming, if you will, had to be done to elicit the cooperation, probably because of the awareness campaign and how we went about doing this. So they needed to be on our side. The university registrar needed to cooperate with our plan, and we were able to accomplish that, and I'll talk a little more about that in a few minutes, what the role the registrar plays in this. Disabled Student Services, we have a role to play in that because we do the alternate format production as well as identify the students who qualify for this type of an accommodation, as well as work directly with students to fulfill whatever their accommodation needs are in this area. We needed to also have in our area of participation our campus bookstore, as well as off-campus bookstores, because they, in essence, control a lot of the material we need to either get our hands on or identify what it is, so we can get about our job of producing the alternate format. So this list kind of gives you a background into the magnitude of the implementation plan we went about establishing here at Cal State Fullerton. Again, this all ties back to our mission statement. If we're going to achieve equal access to our program services and activities, one of the components is ensuring equally effective communications. In order to ensure equally effective communications, first item is timeliness of delivery. We have to have timeliness of delivery. We can't have timeliness of delivery without participation by the entire community. So hopefully that will give you a little more background when you look at how in the world we possibly got everybody to be involved. It was a major effort, but we went about it with a very carefully crafted strategic plan of implementation and involved all of these people. Okay, let's move on. Okay, now we're going to move from background into what I call overview. Okay, the overview is really more like about, if you think of the background as being the development of the implementation plan, the overview is more like implementing the plan and how we went about doing that. The first thing we really needed to get was the a commitment from the president of the university, as well as the vice presidents and the chief information technology officer. All these were when we explained what the situation was and what the objective was and pointed back to the mission statement, it was, I think, understood relatively quickly that this was an important priority that the university needed to address systemically as a community if we were going to achieve timeliness of delivery. I think all the people involved at this level, the high-level administration level, they all understood that if we were to accomplish this, we were going to need the cooperation of primarily the faculty, as well as some other support from the bookstore, information technology, academic affairs, student affairs, etc. So we were able to establish a strong commitment and approval from the president of the university for the implementation plan we developed. The president actually sent out a letter initially to the campus explaining what this was about, what our values are as a community, and that we were going to do this, and there was an expectation on his part that there wouldn't be any resistance. He didn't think that was even going to be an issue because he put it out there with a very positive message, which was, you know, he didn't think there would be any resistance, because why would anybody have any objections to supporting this? Following the president's memo, before we actually, I guess you could say, did our major rollout, as part of the major rollout was a memorandum that went out from the academic vice president to all the deans, chairs, faculty, regarding what this was about, what the expectation was, and it was written in a very positive sort of tone that implied that there wouldn't be any resistance to this. Why would anybody have any resistance to early identifying instructional materials so students with disabilities could have timely delivery and equal access to the materials? So that memo went out under, you know, from the academic vice president's office to all the campus community, and it did specify that the campus had adopted this plan up to the highest administrative level on campus. It was now, you know, in essence, it had been blessed by the president. It was the plan. We were moving forward this. It wasn't up for discussion. And the campus, since the campus had already approved this, the expectation was that everybody was going to comply with it. And the academic vice president did include some language at the tail end of the memo, which I don't know, in essence said that if somebody should choose not to comply with this, they may be found personally liable for any kind of damages that may occur should somebody file a complaint. Since the university has adopted this, the university was intending to support it. The commitment was there from the highest level, but if a faculty member refused to comply and cooperate, then they may be doing it at their own risk. And this is where the Chief Information Technology Officer came in for the sort of the first round of direct involvement with us. In order for us to capture in an organized fashion, early identified instructional materials and adopted textbooks, we needed a tool to do this. And prior to us moving into implementation of this plan, there had been a process in place that had been there for I don't know how long, but it appeared as though it was a number of years, by which each college or department had a responsible individual who wore the badge of textbook coordinator, and that it was that person's job to gather up all the adopted textbook information from the various faculty members and organize it and make sure the orders got transmitted to the bookstore or wherever they were going to order these materials from so they would be there on time. So that was a process that was always already in place, but it wasn't linked to anything in terms of a centralized repository. It was each coordinator had their responsibility, and they would work directly with the bookstore, an off-campus bookstore, or whatever it was going to be. But it was quite challenging sometimes to find out what materials were going to be. So as part of this early adoption process, which was outlined in a memo that went out from the academic VP, it would specify things like textbook adoption, the textbook adoption deadline for the fall semester, which starts for us the last week of August, would be the middle of April, so we'll say April 15th. And for the spring semester, it would be the middle of October. So we have a nice window of opportunity there for us to get our work done, and things get adopted early. What we needed to do was have a tool to collect all this data, all this information about every course, every section of every course. And the Chief Information Technology Officer stepped up to that task, and his commitment was to put from within his available resources, put staff and resources on designing and developing this custom web-based application with the database back end that would be launched, rolled out to the campus. So when the next cycle rolled around for identifying adopted textbooks, this would be in the hands, if you will, of the textbook coordinators. So instead of, they would still collect the information from the faculty as they had in the past, but instead of using the other method, which was fill out a form and fax it to the bookstore for every single book, etc., we gave them a tool which was right on their computer, on their desktop, on a website that they can go to, and all they have to do is identify what all the courses are already on there. So all they have to do is find the section, the course, the faculty, all that stuff's pre-populated in there. So all they have to do is put in like an ISBN number, and the form is actually automatically populated with accurate information about that ISBN number. Then they visually check it. If it's good, they're done. So they love the tool because it made their job a whole lot simpler rather than having post-it notes and scraps of paper and wrong ISBN numbers and many of the things they used to have to deal with in terms of the messiness of ordering textbooks. this worked out quite well, and it was a little bit of a there was a little pushback to it initially, but with the president's commitment, with the vice president's commitment, there's nobody to go to plead your case that you're having trouble with this, or you think it's infringement on your academic freedom, or anything like that. We have no intentions of. And this is explained in the letter from the president as well as the memo from the vice president. We have no intentions of limiting what anybody wants to use in terms of academic freedom. We're just saying you need to identify it so we can get it done. So the campus-wide instructional materials database was developed, and it was rolled out about six semesters ago as a pilot for one semester to kind of get the bugs out of it and make sure everything was working fine. We used it for 100 different courses where we had volunteer faculty. And the following semester, which was the fall of, I believe it was 05, we rolled it out, and it's been in place ever since. I'm going to move on to the next slide now. So, takes a minute. There we go. I had to wait for the slide to come up. Okay. Again, this is some more overview. Now we have the faculty doing early identification through the memo process coming down from the president to the vice presidents. And in addition to that, we developed the it'll come to me in a minute here. We developed the instructional materials database for the entire campus, so early textbook adoptions can go into that database. And the next thing we needed to look at was how could we get our students registered as early as this information has been collected? Because now we have class schedules, we have early identification of information, but students who receive alternate format materials had to wait till priority registration, which was still several weeks forward from when we actually had the textbook information. So what we did was we worked with the registrar to develop a process through which this small number of students, approximately 60 that we serve with alternate formats, is able to do what we call a special early registration. So they're actually going to register about a week, within a week or so of when the class schedule comes out. So say the textbooks are identified by the middle of April. The class schedule was probably out about that same time, probably within a week. So probably by the third week in April, these students who are in this small cohort of students who get alternate format, they're able to early register through this special process. So the registrar was on board with this. They made this special provision, and they every semester around the same time, which is when the course schedule comes out, they check with our office. We give them the identification numbers of the students for the following semester. They input it into their system, and those students then can register extremely early. Okay. The benefit to us is then we have the textbooks identified. We have the students enrolled in the classes they're going to take. So, okay, we got two out of three things here we need. Because just knowing the textbooks isn't enough. You have to know who's going to be taking what classes to then look at what textbooks they're going to need. The way we go from there is once the students have registered, it's their responsibility to contact our alternate format media services specialist and let her know what classes they're enrolled in. They generally do this by email. And they will send her an email and specify, these are the classes, the sections that I'm enrolled in. And then she has privileges to go into the instructional materials database, the campus-wide instructional materials database. It's not open to the general public. But she has, and the people within our program have authorization to go into that database. She can look up what the instructional materials are going to be, textbooks, reader packets, etc., for that student, for those courses that they've identified to her, and then she emails that back to the student. Okay? So we have early identification of textbooks, we have early registration, we know who the students are, they contact our alternate format services specialist who works in our department. She in turn looks up what materials they're going to need and she emails them back to the student. Okay, now it's the student's responsibility to request the materials they want and what alternate format they want them in. We do not do this for the students. There's a number of reasons, but I would say the primary reason is the value we put on independence of our students. We're here to provide them equal access, but we're not there to do things for them that they should be doing for themselves. And we believe, like any other student, students with disabilities, you know, have a responsibility to learn how to independently do things in their own life that they're going to need to do once they graduate. We want to make our students as independent as possible by the time they graduate. So even though we run a program, it's in an Office of Disabled Student Services, we really try our best not to promote dependency. And one of the ways we do it is through, you know, this process. We will send you what you need to order your books and instructional materials in alternate format. It's up to the student to take the next step, which is we have an online, fully accessible alternate format request form, and they need to fill out one of these forms online for each and every one of their instructional material components, like each book. You can't do one for a class. You have to do one for each book, and it'll tell us who it's for, how to get in touch with you, you know, all that kind of personal information, as well as the class, what format it needs to be in, date it's needed by, any comments you have. This instructional materials form, Mark is going to show it to you next week. It is on our website. Anybody's free to go look at it. And we've been using it now since the fall of 2005, and it seems to work quite well. Move on. Okay, let's continue with our overview. Let me check my time here. Running a little long here. Once we receive the online alternate format request from the student, as I said, they submit it online. Once we receive it, that's really when the alternate format production process starts for our program. Now, again, even though we've had to build all this community support, commitment, background to enable this to happen, this is all to bring us, that was all developed to bring us to this point. So we had early identification, and the student could have access to that, and the student could actually request their stuff early, so we could start on it early. So all things going according to schedule, literally we could have the request from the student by the beginning of May for the following fall semester, which starts the end of August. We do encourage our students to do these things as rapidly as possible. Get them to us. The benefit to them is they get their material, you know, in a timely fashion. They may even get it earlier during the summer so they can pre-read it if they want to. But they also have learned, some of them the hard way, that we've built the system, but if you don't take advantage of it and you wait till the first day of class to order your books, you know, you're not going to probably get them for another week or two. So those people who are not the procrastinators, who take advantage of this, who it's really about 75%, 60-75% of the students do get their stuff in early because they know the benefit of it. So, again, it's teaching them independent skills. One of the things that really helps out with these early requests is it really helps us manage our production workflow. And for those of you who are involved in production, even it doesn't even have to be a large scale production. As you know, there's this big spike at the beginning of the semester where everybody wants their stuff. Well, it's virtually impossible to achieve timely delivery with that kind of a scenario. So what we're able to do is we're able to, you know, actually much more efficiently utilize our resources of staffing, skilled, trained people, hardware and software, everything that goes into producing alternate format materials. If we can level out this spike a little bit. If we know before students leave for the summer what they're going, you know, say 60-70% of these students are going to need when they come back in the fall. Hey, you know, instead of twiddling our thumbs all summer, we're working. You know, we have a workflow process in place. Hands are busy, and things are moving forward. So when it gets to that last week before class and we start seeing an increase in requests, we've already gotten, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80% of our work, 75-80% of our work prepared. It's ready to go. So it's not that we don't have a spike, because we do, and we probably will always continue to have a spike because there's students who are new students, don't know about the program for whatever reason. But we only have, you know, 20%, 25% at the most of the students using alternate format materials contributing to that spike. The rest of them are pretty much done. So early identification really does help out with managing your production workflow. And this was actually one of the things that we had emphasized during the development of the implementation plan to administrators, that, you know, in terms of resources we need to run this program, the better we can manage it in terms of workflow, the more efficiently we can do this job. Not only in terms of achieving timely delivery, but in terms of resource management. We don't have a situation where, you know, we have people, we don't have anything for them to do, so we lay them off so they have to leave. As those of you who do this kind of work, I'm sure are well aware, it's not easy to find people who will do this kind of work, who have the talent to do this kind of work, and all around are, you know, the valued employees doing this kind of work. And if you find them and if you train them, I've always thought the best thing to try to do is retain them. And in order to retain them, you need work for them to do on a consistent basis. So this really helps all around. Another part that we have built that Mark is going to show you next week that involved a chief information technology officer is it's an online alternate format request tracking status application that allows students to go to their web portal 24/7. Once they're on their web portal, they're linked to a web application that will tell them what the status of their requests are. So if they've put in a request, submitted a request, they can go and they can look there within a day or so and see, okay, it's been received, it's been approved, you know, what the estimated date of completion is, the material has been ordered, the material has been obtained, the material is in production, and so forth and so on, all the way down to, you know, ready for pickup and date and time, etc. We do that for each and every job we do. It really gets initiated as soon as we receive a request and we start working on something through our internal tracking database, which Mark's going to show you next week. But this is an important component because it enables the students, it empowers the students to know what's going on with their work, when it's going to be ready. They can actually look and see the production timeline of it. And it also keeps a lot of people from coming and asking us, when is my stuff going to be ready? Okay, we were trying to really avoid a lot of our staff time being taken up by answering these types of questions. So by automating this process where this information, the data is harvested from our database, goes to this web application, and it's available to the students 24/7, they don't need to call us. to find out this information, and they can see what's going on with all their books, and we can do our job, and they can get what they need. And again, it's all automated. So once we put it into our database and we're tracking it in terms of production, that is reflected in the student's status request database. Okay, let's move on. Wait for my slide to come up here. Okay, while we're looking at the overview, again, the point of the overview is so you guys get a better picture of what goes on when Mark steps in and he shows you this production process and the tools we use, and you don't sit there and go, wow, how did they ever do that? Okay, this is how we do it in terms of the staffing and things like that, as well as the commitment from the entire campus. The primary staff we have to work with is myself, the Information Computer Access Program Coordinator. I oversee the whole operation as well as, you know, work with my administrators and deal with campus-wide issues and commitments, and I kind of work at that level now. Now, Mark Trin is the Instructional Materials Accessibility Specialist, and he really oversees everything it has to do with production and distribution of the alternate format materials. We have our newest member is our alternate format media services specialist, Elizabeth Buchanan, and what she does is she handles a lot of the kind of the customer service end of it for Mark. So Mark can concentrate on production. Elizabeth, her role is to, for instance, when the student originally submits their class schedule. Actually, ahead of that, she'll send out an announcement to all the students by email that are in our cohort of alt format people saying, your special early registration, you know, time is, and she'll give them the window that they can go in and do that. And she works with the registrar to give them all the names of the people that need to have this priority access. She takes care of that. Then when the students are after they've registered, they submit to her their class schedule. She goes to the instructional materials, campus-wide instructional materials database, gets the information about the instructional materials, emails it back to the students. The students then do their requests. Once they do their online requests, those come to Elizabeth. Elizabeth's the first person to process them. She receives that alternate format request and then starts to obtain the material in an alternate format if it's available. If not, it moves forward. She in essence packages it up and it moves on to Mark with the instructions as to how to process it. And then when Mark's through with it, it comes back to Elizabeth. Elizabeth handles the distribution to the students as well as the receipt process and puts that information back into our database. So in essence, I think of it as if you're used to taking your car, say, to a dealership or to a doctor's office or something, there's somebody who is sort of the customer service person who works the front line with the customer, the person with the clipboard, if you will, the person who works the front counter. But the actual technician frequently doesn't interact with the customer, and that's really the way we've set this up. Mark rarely will interact with a student unless there's some question he needs to contact them about. But all the front-end kind of work, as I see, the service delivery part of it is handled by Elizabeth. Then we have Roman Hernandez, who's actually Roman is our newest member of the instruction or the Information and Computer Access Program. He's our new Adaptive Technology Specialist. He handles a network of 50 computers campus-wide, all the imaging, the updates, the patches, the security, the configurations, what else? Those are for students. Then we have staff support. We provide for about a dozen faculty members for different types of adaptive software, hardware, et cetera, et cetera. So he handles the technology end of it, of what we do, trains students, works on proposals for further development. We're in the process now of developing a a data center for setting up some servers, which he will be administering for us for some other things we're going to be doing involving captioning and things like that. So he's our tech guy, but he's also the adaptive technology specialist, and he reports to me. This was a job I used to have years ago when I wore every hat. Now this is his hat. But then we have several graduate assistants. Actually, right now we only have two graduate assistants and several service contractors who are people who work under contract outside the university. We contract with them for everything from Braille transcription, specialized Braille transcription, e-text editing, tactile graphics production, things that, you know, we might need specialized talent that we don't. Primarily, the reason is we don't have the space on our campus. As I said earlier, we are confined with the amount of space we have to actually do production. So, some of these tasks we contract, I would say minimally, with outside contractors. Most of our e-text goes out to outside contractors for editing. People all over the country we've worked with who work for us, we send them the scanned OCR'd file along with the print material, and they get about doing all the cleanup for accuracy, putting in the page numbers, reformatting, doing all the stuff you need to do to get a clean, accurate, well-formatted e-text following OCR. Our Braille transcription process is we do all the embossing here, we'll do all the scanning here, we'll send, in essence, what we do is we send out a clean edited file to somebody. So if we have to do something in Braille, we will, if it's beyond our capacity to do it in-house, we do almost all the literary stuff in-house. But if it's going to be math, it's going to be calculus, it's going to be music, things, something we don't have the talent here to do, we will prepare it to the extent we can. Then we send it out to a transcriber. The transcriber transcribes it to a file format that we specify, sends it back to us, and we do the actual embossing and binding, the production end of it, in-house here. So it actually works out quite well, and we can move material very quickly that way. We don't have to wait for somebody to emboss it and ship it back and forth and stuff. If I need some sheet music done, I can usually get it done within 2 hours by sending it to the person who does the transcription. I just scan it to a PDF. I attach the PDF to an email to this individual. He completes the process and he sends me back the Duxbury ready file, and we just emboss it on our end. And like I say, we can turn around something like this in sometimes less than 2 hours. So, and we do the same thing with another transcriber who does foreign language and things like that for us. So it actually works out quite well. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. Almost done here, guys. Wait for this to come up. Still waiting. Okay, I gotta pause this for a second because I lost my next slide. Okay, I'm back. Got the slide working. I want to talk a little about the alternate format production center infrastructure, just briefly go over that, and then conclude here in a couple of minutes. The first thing we have is really our online alternate format request form, which Mark will show you next week. We have access to something called the CAM database, or the Center for Accessible Media, which is part of the California State University system, and it's a whole other presentation in itself, which I hope you'll have an opportunity to hear about it, that Easy will be able to get the people who do the CAM database at the Chancellor's office to do a presentation on it. But, you know, shortly, just a short answer on what it does, it provides us a resource for ordering books from publishers in electronic format. It documents all that, generates the forms, does an amazing number of things, which really does streamline the process for those of us short on time out in the field. It also facilitates sharing of alternate formats between the 23 campuses of the CSU. So, for an example, once we get a request from a student, and this is what our alternate format media services specialist will do. She'll take that request and she'll look in the CAM database. Now you guys can't look in it. It's password protected. It's only for CSU and only for a limited number of login or authorized people within the CSU, because there are some serious copyright issues here that need to be protected. But she'll go to the CAM database, for instance. If she gets a hit on a record for that, then we can order it. We can order that alternate format from another campus who has already produced it, and they can upload it to a digital Dropbox, and we can download it. And again, this can all happen in a matter of minutes. If she doesn't find it, she initiates a record, and then we will be the ones that other people will look to when they log into this database and say, "Hey, oh, I got a hit. It's at Cal State Fullerton." So they'll come to us to get it. So if it's not already there, a record gets generated. As part of the record generation process, there is a simple function, I guess you could say, to the person creating a record. When you finish creating a record, there's a button at the bottom that says, "Hey, do you want to order this from the publisher?" Actually, it doesn't say "Hey." It says "Request order from publisher." If you select that button, it will at that point assist you with generating the necessary request forms, documents, et cetera, to fax to the publisher. If they don't have a web solution, if they do, it'll assist you with that. But it expedites the process by you fill out the record once, and the information you put in a record now will populate all your forms, the ISBN number, the publisher, all that stuff. So you don't have to keep typing it into fields over and over and over again. And then you can just, in many instances, fax this information directly to a publisher. And if they're going to fulfill it, at least you've made the request. If they don't fulfill it, we go ahead and we'll go ahead and create the alternate format ourselves. But the CAM database really does provide us a great tool for doing that. That came online in the summer of, I believe it was 2004, and they currently have around 9,000 titles in there. We have constructed an alternate format tracking database, which is the heart and soul of our alternate format production process. And Mark is going to show you that next week. It's a really nice tool. We couldn't do what we do without it. And Mark has done a great job of, I guess you could say, analyzing the process and developing this tool. We have our alternate format production center, which are the computers, the scanners, the space, the tables, the chairs, that kind of stuff. And Mark's going to explain more about that next week. As I said earlier, we have our online alternate format request tracking status application. That's run by IT and web services that provides the conduit through which the students can see what the status of their requests are. We have an alternate format request pickup receipt process that is sort of the closure to each and every job. So as it's transcended, a particular work has moved through this process from the top of this list of a submission, a request submission, it concludes with the pickup receipt, then which the information in the pickup receipt goes back into concluding a job within a database, as well as that receipt is then stored by us and signed by the student, so we know who got it, when they got it, etc., etc. It's well organized, and again, it's part of the alternate format request tracking database process that we get that closure for a record, so we know who picked it up, when they picked it up, and things of that nature. So we go back and we generate reports from this to analyze our timeliness delivery and things like that to see how we're doing in that department. Are we achieving timeliness of delivery, which in most instances we are. And it's through this process of early identification and the whole community being involved that we've really been able to achieve that. If we just had this stuff that you in this list of the infrastructure, this is kind of what we were working with before, and it doesn't help us with timeliness of delivery if we don't have early identification. So let's move on. Okay, let's look at the review of what we talked about today. And again, just to recap, the reason I've taken so much of your time to try to break this down into a kind of a historical overview and background is so when Mark steps up in 2 weeks and does his presentation, there won't be a lot of questions about, well, how in the world did you ever, you know, get them to buy in? How did you ever accomplish this? You know, why can't we do this on our campus? Nobody, the faculty won't cooperate and all those things. That's part of our process, was to build that that community participation and cooperation from the start. Okay, let's just briefly recap what we did today. We began with our mission statement, which was Section 504 and ADA Title II. What we wanted to look at was why we do what we do and how will we know if we've achieved it. And why we do what we do is because we are responsible for providing equal access to our program services and activities and make sure or ensure equally effective communication to all our students, both written and oral. In order to really evaluate if we've met that criteria, we look at the standards that have been set out by the Office for Civil Rights, U.S. Department of Education, which are timeliness of delivery. That is, everybody, you know, our students who use alt format get it the same time as everyone else. Accuracy of delivery, which means everything we deliver to the student is as accurate as material in any book. The reason I say that, there are mistakes in books, and generally we leave the mistakes in if they're in there. So we accurately translate whatever's in a book, even if it's not right, if that makes sense. And finally, delivering material in a preferred format to the student and appropriate to the nature of the material being presented. Okay, that's what we're out to accomplish. That's what the background is being presented, so you can understand what our target is and how we evaluate if we've achieved our objective. To accomplish this, we had to establish a university-wide commitment and implementation plan. That was really essential to accomplishing something of this magnitude. In order to do this, one of the key components is early identification of instructional materials. Okay, on to the next slide. Now we're almost done here. Back to we're still going to be working on the review of part one here. In addition to the early identification of materials, we needed to have early registration of the students, so we worked with the registrar to accomplish that. We needed to also be focused on retaining sufficiently skilled staff, and part of this is done by, you know, workflow management. Part of it is by having a reasonable training program. Part of it is by paying people, compensating them at a level that they are comfortable and can afford to continue working for us. But it's essential to have sufficiently trained staff. We also looked at how can we maintain an appropriately skilled and infrastructure that we can scale when demand peaks. And part of the way we do this is the combination of managing our workflow as best as possible through early identification and all the processes we've talked about, and to use outside service contractors who we can ramp up at certain times by, you know, calling in more troops, so to speak, to handle a workload as things advance. If we get 10 more students in a semester, we can use outside contractors in the interim. If it's going to be a sort of a temporary situation, we may stay using outside contractors. Or if it's the program is just growing by and the population is expected to continue at that level, then you know we would adjust our resources and we would go out and try to expand our program. But the service contractors provide us that flexibility when we need it to scale the program to the appropriate level at any given time. Really, I think what we've accomplished in terms of our community involvement has tremendous benefits to everybody across the board within the community. It's good for the administrators because they have an increased awareness of what needs to happen. They've come to an understanding, a level of awareness that they know early identification means more efficient utilization of resources, being funding, staff, and space. We don't need so much staff. Our funding can stay, you know, predictably constant. We don't have a lot of spiked periods where we have, you know, budget overloads and things of that nature. It's good for the students, of course, because they get their stuff on time. It's good for the staff, being folks like me, because we're not pulling our hair out a week before the semester starts and saying there's no way we can get this done, and people quit. You know, we found when we had those situations, it was really hard to retain good qualified employees because they would just say, this is crazy. I'm going to go work somewhere else where it's not so crazy. And you know, there is a benefit to the faculty. It helps them know what's coming up down the line. It's easier for them in terms of textbook adoption. So there's benefits all across campus that I think most of you probably realize. But once you can get a high level of community involvement, you really can start to leverage these benefits in many ways. Okay, now we're down to the end, which is questions and answers from you guys. And I'll be happy to take any questions that anybody wants to ask. But we're also planning on taking all the questions that have come in the text chat window, and we will be sorting through them and probably summarizing to some degree, taking out the repetitive questions and things like that. And my plan is to answer all the questions as kind of succinctly as possible. And if you're interested in a copy of that, please include your email in the chat window, and I will be glad to send you a copy of the finished responses to all your questions. So on behalf of Mark and Norm, I would like to say thanks for coming, and we'll look forward to seeing all of you in 2 weeks for Mark's presentation on production and tracking. Bye now.